Huge news from the soccer world. After almost two decades with Barcelona, Lionel Messi has told the club he wants out.
This is Tom Brady playing for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers times a million. None of us thought this would happen.
In a year when stunning news seems to happen every week, this ranks near the top. Lionel Messi, arguably the greatest soccer player who has ever lived, announced he wants to leave the team he's played for his entire career, FC Barcelona, and take his talents to, well, we don't know that part yet. But billions of soccer fans around the world are waiting breathlessly to find out. Today, ESPN's Sam Borden tells us why Messi decided it was time to break up with Barca and where he might be headed next. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Tuesday, September 1st. This is ESPN Daily. Sam Borden, 6 years ago, we were in Brazil together, and my facial hair situation was not good.
I mean, that isn't what stands out for me, Pablo, but, you know, I think we all have different memories of experiences.
Sam Borden is a global sports correspondent for ESPN, and kind enough to forget the unfortunate beard I grew for 5 weeks while we were covering the 2014 World Cup.
It's actually kind of funny, right? I mean, that World Cup in Brazil, Lionel Messi was a big part of the story there, and obviously he's a big part of the story today, too.
We got to see Leo Messi in a World Cup final, Sam, and you fast forward 6 years, and I bring you here today because Messi announced last week that he wants to leave FC Barcelona after a nearly 17-year stint. Tell me why this is a big deal.
The obvious answer is that Messi is the most famous athlete on the planet, maybe one of the most famous people in the entire world. He is not just a generational star. He's a star that defines a sport. When you talk about people that are known all over the world for being absolute craftsmen, absolute artisans at what they do, Messi is that guy.
It's a brilliant run for Messi. Did he go all the way?
He's a little guy from Argentina who is an absolute wizard with a soccer ball.
He is just a conjurer, a ripper up of reason, a perennial Caesar of the day.
He's magical, he's calculating, he's one of the most creative players the sport has ever seen.
What?
I think one of the things that has always made him even bigger than just the typical stars you see in other sports is his diminutive stature. He's not a giant. He's not one of these massive bodies. I've been in front of him several times, and I'm 5'10", and I look down on him quite a bit. To me, that's what makes him so endearing and so beloved by so many people is that he kind of roams among giants and somehow finds a way to succeed in a way that no other player ever has.
And coming up with the ball, Lionel Messi. Oh, he hasn't, has he?
He made Barcelona the juggernaut that it is today. And him moving on, that's a massive seismic shift, not just in soccer, but in sports.
Leo Messi is listed at 5'7". So you literally look down on Messi, but the rest of soccer does look up to him. So give me a sense of his achievements at Barcelona.
I've always been enamored with Wayne Gretzky's records in hockey. You know, like you sort of look at those and you're kind of like, wow, nobody's ever played this sport better than this player. I mean, he like every possible record. And Messi is kind of the same way. I mean, he's won six Ballons d'Or, which is like the player of the year, four Champions Leagues with Barcelona, 10 Spanish titles. And like the individual numbers are staggering. He holds the scoring record with Barcelona. He's got the most goals in a season in all of Europe. He's got the most goals in a season in Spain. He's got the most hat tricks, the most two-goal games. He's got the assist record. It's sort of the perpetual argument, but I am somebody who believes that he's the greatest player in soccer history.
So here are the superstars, a galaxy of greats representing clubs from Spain and Germany, Barcelona and Bayern Munich, teams who have helped make the Champions League what it is today.
Just 2 weeks ago, Messi and Barcelona were playing against Bayern Munich in the quarterfinal of the Champions League. And the Champions League, for those uninitiated, is the most prestigious club tournament in Europe. What happened in that particular match?
Barcelona lost 8-2 to Bayern Munich.
And here's Coutinho, and he's got another one.
This is ridiculous.
It's eight.
This is ridiculous.
Eight, and it's absolutely embarrassing for Barcelona.
Absolutely embarrassing. Hang your heads in shame, Barcelona, because this is awful.
Those kinds of results don't happen. Messi is used to winning on these kinds of stages. This season is the first season in 12 years Barcelona haven't won some trophy of any kind. They didn't win the Spanish League title. They didn't win the Champions League. They didn't even win the Copa del Rey, which is sort of like the domestic tournament that happens in the middle of the season in Spain. Whatever is going on, you can usually win the Copa del Rey, and they didn't win that either. It was the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back. 8-2, an absolute embarrassment. After the game, several players, including Gerard Piqué, who's been on Barcelona forever, said, "This is the bottom. Literally, you're looking at rock bottom."
So there at the bottom, the camel's back is fractured. What was the fallout from that loss in the immediate term?
The manager, Quique Setién, was basically fired before the team got to baggage claim on the flight home. There was no doubt that he was going. The director of football, Eric Abidal, he was sent packing as well. And it began this sort of tumultuous cycle that, in truth, Barcelona has been in for quite some time. They've had three managers in 8 months. The team has spent 750 million euros over the last couple of years and somehow hasn't gotten any better. And so I think in the aftermath of this loss to Bayern, you saw just like the beginning of a sea change. They bring in a new manager, Ronald Koeman, who's a Dutch manager, played for Barcelona when he was a player. And he comes in, basically the first thing he does is tell a whole bunch of veteran players, including Luis Suarez, who is Messi's neighbor and closest friend on the team, "Hey, thanks, but we're not going to need you anymore going forward." And then when Koeman sits down with Messi, there are some differing reports on how that conversation went. Some reports have been that he told Messi, "Hey, look, the days of any special privileges for you at this club are over." Some people say that he was a little more diplomatic than that, but just saying like, "Hey, look, we're about to change gears here and you need to be prepared for that." But either way, Messi came away from that conversation not feeling particularly warm and fuzzy about this place that he's been a part of and been at the center of for almost two decades.
So what does Leo Messi, in response to this treatment, unprecedented by his boss, what does he do next?
Well, this is where it gets kind of funny. And I feel like, you know, Pablo, you and I are similar in that we appreciate the sort of eccentric minutiae of sports.
Yes.
What Messi does is he sends what's called a burofax, essentially a notarized letter to Barcelona telling them, "I'm ready to go." A bomb dropped in the laps of everybody in Barcelona, and they send a burofax back saying like, well, we don't want you to go. We really would love for you to stay, but also you're under contract." And this is where it gets a little bit complicated and very well might end up with some lawyers involved, because Messi claims that his contract says he's allowed to leave for free as long as he tells Barcelona before the end of the given season. The end of the European soccer season is in June. Obviously, during the pandemic, the Champions League just recently ended. And Messi says, hey, look, I sent you the Burrow facts in between when our season ended and the Champions League final. I'm free to leave without having to pay anything. And Barcelona obviously would prefer not to let their billion-dollar player walk out the door for nothing, so they're arguing otherwise. And I think ultimately that will be something that has to be negotiated out.
So what's the price tag that Barcelona is putting on Messi's departure then?
So it's a little bit complicated. It's not quite like free agency or trades in American sports. In international soccer, there are transfer fees, and that's basically a fee that has to be paid to a team before a player is allowed to leave. In this case, Barcelona is saying that Messi's contract includes a clause that says for him to leave the team, they need to be paid $825 million. Now, that's obviously a lot of money. Just for some comparison, when Cristiano Ronaldo left Real Madrid and went to Juventus, the transfer fee was $117 million. So this has gotten a little bit tricky for both sides. Messi is holding his ground. He hasn't showed up to take the preseason COVID test that all the other players are taking. He isn't interested in being part of any of the preseason training that's going on. And Barcelona is digging in and saying, look, we understand this is how you feel, but we feel very strongly that we're owed this money if you want to go.
But as with any breakup, Sam, there is a tipping point, but there are also symptoms before. So what led up to all of this?
I think ultimately the trust between Messi and the board of Barcelona just completely deteriorated. Before this season, Messi talked with Josep Maria Bartomeu, the president of Barcelona, and he talked to him about the idea that maybe Neymar, who had been with Barcelona, left to go to Paris Saint-Germain, and was interested in coming back to Barcelona, Messi wanted Neymar to come back. And he's close with Neymar, he's friends with Neymar. He wanted Neymar to return, and he was told, hey, we're going to do everything we can to get Neymar back in Barcelona. He's going to help fix this. And so Messi felt good about that. But then that didn't happen. According to Messi, he had questions about whether Bartomeu was being truthful to him and actually going full length to get Neymar back. So Bartomeu knows that he's squarely in the spotlight here. Obviously, this is a huge deal that's on his watch as president. If you're the president of Barcelona that loses Messi, that's something that's going to hang with you for quite some time. So in the last week or so, he has come out publicly and has offered to resign. He says, look, Messi, if you stay, I'll go. Obviously, that's a pretty big concession that he's willing to make. But in the end, I'm not sure that that's going to be enough to change Messi's mind. I think the next step that we're going to see in terms of significant progress one way or another is there have been reports that Messi and his father, who's also his agent, are going to meet with Bartomeu and other Barcelona executives in the middle of this week in Spain. And hopefully, at that point, there will be some kind of progress towards a resolution on whether this transfer fee is going to be paid or not.
So one of my favorite aspects of soccer, Sam, is the gossip. And the latest gossip is pretty juicy. The leading candidate for Messi reportedly is Manchester City. And Manchester City is considering a contract that will eventually include a move to NYCFC, the MLS team, because both teams are under the same ownership. So what would the reaction be from soccer fans if Messi comes to the United States to play?
It would be amazing, obviously. And as much as I love to imagine Messi living like in Brooklyn and becoming like, you know, a full-on hipster, I think that is less likely than him going to Manchester City, which I do think is very likely. You know, the reason why Manchester City has been mentioned as sort of the front runner is twofold. One, they're one of the few clubs in the world that has enough money to actually pay him. But two, and I think more significantly in some ways, is their manager is Pep Guardiola. And Pep Guardiola was the manager at Barcelona from 2008 to 2012, which is like the golden years in Barcelona's history. And I think when you look at the potential landing spots for where Messi's going to be, Manchester City is number one by leaps and bounds. Whether that means he'll actually end up coming to New York and hanging out with you and me at a coffee shop, I don't necessarily see that happening, but it is a fun possibility to dream on, that's for sure.
All right, so you explained why this is such a huge deal for soccer fans around the world. But after the break, I want you to tell me, as someone who spent a little bit of time around Messi himself, what the most famous athlete on the planet is actually like.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with the smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured, it was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo, another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
Sam, you profiled Messi ahead of the World Cup in 2018. How would you describe, from your vantage point, his personality?
His personality is fascinating to me. He is literally the most famous athlete in the world. And he is, I think, also maybe the quietest superstar that I've ever come across. He is not Muhammad Ali.
I am the king of the world. I'm a bad man. I shook up the world.
He is not LeBron James.
Cleveland, this is for you.
He is not any of these guys that are out there chirping about themselves or even talking about significant world issues and using their platform to speak on things that are important to them. He is quiet.
Me gustó, me empecé a jugar con 3 o 4 años, ya pateaba.
It's an interesting juxtaposition because as an Argentine, he's so often compared to Diego Maradona, who is the exact opposite of that. It really makes for an interesting push-pull in how we imagine what a modern superstar athlete is supposed to be. In a lot of ways, Messi is his own. He's kind of defined his own persona that is very different than what we've seen from the guys that have that kind of pulpit.
Messi is held at a certain remove. I mean, access to him is a mythically exclusive thing. So as part of that assignment, did you get to spend time with the guy?
I spent a little bit of time with him. He allowed us to come to a photo shoot and a TV commercial being filmed. And we were supposed to have a sit-down interview. But a couple of days before that, he canceled that in-person interview and said, you know, just email me some questions and I'll respond to them. So, you know, I did email him some questions and he responded to maybe a quarter of the ones that I sent to him. And even then, the answers were, let's just say my sense was that he wasn't the one sitting at the keyboard pecking out the answers back. So you're right. Like, in terms of a guy of his stature, the visibility and the accessibility is as minimal as you could imagine.
Has he always been this shy, even as a little kid?
He's always been this way. He was a shy kid. He was a quiet kid. When he was growing up in Argentina, he had a very modest upbringing. The story that I always love is when he was a kid and, you know, sort of trying to figure out what inspired him to play, his coaches hit upon, okay, well, he really likes these Argentine cookies called alfajores. And so they offered him a cookie for every goal he scored. And they said, okay, we'll give you 2 cookies if you can score a goal with your head. Because, you know, he was smaller. They wanted to encourage him to kind of get in the mix and score header goals and not just rely on dribbling around everybody and tapping the ball in the net. So what does Messi do? Okay, I want those 2 cookies. The next game, he goes out, gets the ball, dribbles around every single defender, including the goalkeeper, flicks the ball up in the air, and heads it into the net from about 6 inches away because he wanted to make sure he got the 2 cookies instead of the 1.
So how did Messi make his way over to Barcelona as this small, shy, quiet child?
it's an interesting story. You know, essentially, I mean, obviously his talent was immense. And at the time, Barcelona offered to pay for his hormone treatment. I mean, like I said, he was a small kid, and it was pretty clear that his growth was not typical, and he was going to need some fairly expensive medical treatments. So Barcelona said, look, come to our academy, we will pay for all of his treatments, and he'll become part of our youth team over here.
Hmm.
So he moves to Barcelona from Argentina when he's 13 years old, and he never left. He moved his way up through the youth teams, made his debut with the senior team, and went on to become the greatest player in club history. But it all began with the idea that he needed to go somewhere where he could get enough money to pay for his hormone treatments, and Barcelona offered him that opportunity.
So hold on. To be clear, the origin story of Leo Messi at Barcelona involves HGH? Is that what we're talking about?
I can't speak exactly to what the cocktail of drugs was at that time. And I'm certainly not a doctor to know what a undersized tween needs to continue to grow appropriately. But I don't think anybody in their wildest dreams could have imagined that the kid coming over in part to get hormone treatments was going to turn out to be the greatest player in the history of the sport.
Unlike his main rival, perhaps, Cristiano Ronaldo, who's now bounced around from a couple of high-profile teams, Messi has spent the last 20 years consecutively in Barcelona, basically his whole adult life, and that's been his home. So when you psychoanalyze this, Sam, do you think that accumulated time will make it harder for Leo Messi to leave?
I don't. It's actually one of the most fascinating parts of the reporting that I did a couple of years ago for me was to realize exactly what the dynamic is between Messi and the city. There's a saying sort of among Barcelona fans and journalists there that over the years that, you know, Messi lives in Barcelona. He plays in the Camp Nou. He fills that stadium every night. And then after the game, he goes home to Argentina. Which obviously literally isn't true. He doesn't, you know, go home to Argentina after every game. But his entire world that he has created around him in Barcelona is his Argentine family, his Argentine friends, his Argentine crew. He used to eat at an Argentine restaurant that was down the road from his house. That was like the only place that he would eat. All of the fans in Barcelona noticed that after 20 years, he still speaks with an Argentine accent when he speaks Spanish. Mm. He doesn't speak Catalan, and that was noticed. So yes, he is the centerpiece of the club. He is a huge part of the city in terms of its identity, but his relationship and his connection to the city isn't quite as tight as you might imagine. And I think he went to Barcelona early enough in his career where he could have chosen to play for the Spanish national team. And he continued to play for Argentina. If he had played for Spain, he would have been a European champion. He would have been a World Cup champion.
Yep.
He stayed with Argentina and he hasn't won anything with them.
So outside of the turmoil with his current club, I am now super curious. What else could possibly be motivating him? Like, what do you get the man who already seems to have everything in terms of awards and reputation and accomplishments? What does that guy want after accomplishing everything you possibly can at the club level?
From a sort of maybe more cynical perspective, Messi's very aware of the comparisons between him and Cristiano Ronaldo. For sure, that's, you know, front of mind both for him and for Ronaldo. And right now, he has the same number of European championships as Ronaldo. He's won four, Ronaldo's won four. And so I do think that there is in his mind the idea that, okay, let me go take one more crack at winning another one, maybe giving me one leg up in terms of that argument as it's going to go down in history as one of the greatest sports arguments of all time. Who is better? This is a way to help differentiate me from Ronaldo. I think that's a possibility. But I think ultimately the question is the same one that it is for all of these athletes that kind of continue on after it seems like they have everything. He just wants to show that he can still do it. He's 33 years old. He's changed somewhat the way that he plays. He's not as aggressive as he was 10 years ago. He's made some concessions to his age, but he's still amazing. And I think ultimately with any of these guys, they know that they have a short window relative to the rest of their life to show just how brilliant they are. And I believe that he just thinks he's not quite ready to be done yet.
That brings to mind a more domestic player, Tom Brady. You just talked about wanting to prove that you can still do it. And Brady might be the best analog for Leo Messi in America, the greatest of all time, arguably, in his sport, a guy who spent decades with one team exclusively, but now relocates to Tampa Bay this past offseason. And it was shocking at the time when we saw it happen. But will it shock you if Messi finally actually pulls the parachute cord and leaves Barcelona in the way that Brady left New England?
I think it's a totally fair question. And I think you're right. The comparison between them is very reasonable. And I think ultimately what both of their circumstances show is that as much as fans like to believe that these guys are wedded to the team that they're on, the motivation for all of them ultimately is themselves. They believe that they can play at a certain level. They believe that they are as good in their minds as they are on the field. And they believe that they can still be at that level. And so I think ultimately in both cases, Brady and Messi, a lot of what this comes down to is the belief that I can do this. I still can achieve all of the things that I've achieved so far. And I can do it in a different place, thus proving it's me. It's not what's going on around me. It's me.
Sam Borden, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks, Pablo.
Coming up, why the late John Thompson's nickname barely begins to take the true measure of the legendary coach.
When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine, especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
Here's another story I want you to know. They called him Big John, but now the adjective feels like understatement. John Thompson died yesterday at age 78, and losing the patriarch of Georgetown basketball made the sports world shudder. Thompson stood just under 7 feet tall, but his stature in college sports can't properly be measured on paper. You'll hear that Thompson was the first black coach to win an NCAA championship in 1984, and that he won 7 Big East titles, and that he turned the Hoyas into the seminal hoops dynasty of the 80s. But to feel how radically he changed the culture of college basketball, you need to talk to the people who were changed by him too. Like NBA Hall of Famer Allen Iverson.
I want to thank Coach Thompson. Coach Thompson for saving my life.
J.A. Adande had a front row seat to Thompson and Iverson's time together. So I asked him what it was like to cover Big John as a young reporter. So, J.A., you covered Georgetown basketball for the Washington Post. And when you get in front of John Thompson, describe for me what that feeling is like to stand in front of that guy and cover him as a journalist.
You're shaking, if not physically, then metaphorically, internally. There's some shaking and some fear. But it also brings out a lot of you too. You have to be able to go toe to toe with him. And one thing with him, he was intimidating. But if you back down from him, you're going to lose. And more importantly, he's going to lose respect for you. So I wanted that respect. And, you know, so I did want to be able to stand up to him and to not cower in a way, because he was going to try to intimidate you.
So he was the first Black coach to win an NCAA championship in basketball. He was this seminal figure. How would you characterize, for those who aren't familiar, what John Thompson did through the lens of race that was so revolutionary in sports?
He took a stand, for one thing. And we were talking about boycotts in the last week in the NBA and across sports. And John Thompson did that. The NCAA was trying to institute Proposition 48, which meant you had to have certain GPA and test scores in order to be eligible your freshman year. And then so John Thompson and John Chaney at Temple basically battled against the arbitrary nature and the bias of the standardized test scores that were being used, and saying that was going to have an adverse effect on Black players. And then on top of that, they said if you didn't qualify under Prop 48, you'd be ineligible for financial aid. And so now what Thompson and Chaney is saying, you're denying the opportunity for these kids to be able to attend school. And so they're ready to boycott until the NCAA back down. And John Thompson walked off the court over that proposal and took that stand, and the NCAA back down in.
So you have described how difficult at times John Thompson was to deal with as a journalist. What was it like to deal with him if you were a player and Big John was your coach?
I think it's a game at Madison Square Garden with Allen Iverson and two of his players. You know, they were counter fear, and it was basically like, you tell him, no, you tell him. And Allen Iverson says, you tell him, I don't want yelling at me. There was another time in a, you know, early season game, non-conference opponent, they're blowing him out. And one of his players does this 360 dunk. And John Thompson did not appreciate his players showing up the opponent like that. So he goes down the sideline, grabs the nearest player he could find by the jersey, literally throws him to the scorer's table so that he can check in and he can get this guy who is showboating out of there. But I'll never forget that. He just reached down, those big hands of his, grabs him and just throws him down. You didn't want to disappoint him, and you didn't want him scolding you. And you also just didn't want him physically looming over you.
So it was difficult to cover John Thompson. It was perhaps even more difficult to play for John Thompson. But despite all of that, you've described a man towards whom so many people feel a really conspicuous warmth. How are you going to remember Big John, J.A.?
As an iconic figure that I was fortunate enough to cover, as someone who cared deeply. So a big part of the 90s and late 80s was, as the Knicks would go on their playoff runs, John Thompson was always in the front row for Patrick Ewing's games, and he never left it. And it's one of the most important and significant relationships. I maintain that Patrick Ewing is the most significant player in college basketball history, not the greatest. But if you look at what Georgetown was before he got there, what it was during his time there, and what it meant to the legacy that he left behind, I don't think you can find someone who transformed a program as much as Patrick Ewing did at Georgetown. And so therefore the bond, and John would talk about that. He'd say, other players like Dikembe Mutombo would say, how come you're not in my games? You know, you're at all of Patrick's games. How come you can't come to more of my game? And John would say, Patrick comes first, and Patrick came first. And that hierarchy was never disputed. No Final Fours before John Thompson gets there. The program really isn't on the map nationally, right? Their greatest player is Paul Tagliabue. And anytime your best player
is the commissioner of the NFL,
commissioner of another sport, you know, that tells you something. But Patrick Ewing transformed that program. You know, they go to three Final Fours, three championship games, and win once. And so that relationship was so special. He was just as proud of the ones who went on to careers in business or education. And they would all tell you how much he meant to them and how much he checked in on them after their careers. But he was most visibly associated with Patrick Ewing, and he would just be there supporting him for every big playoff game.
J.A. Adande, thank you for reminiscing about Big John with me today.
You're welcome, Pablo. Thanks for having me on. And Big John is just such a towering figure, and I'm happy to share my memories with him.
I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.